Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about parenting kids with prenatal alcohol and drug exposure. It's a panel of moms, and we're going to be talking about the real-life experiences, not the pie in the sky. It might happen, but what is it really like? I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. You can find us online at creatingafamily.org. You can subscribe to this podcast and be notified on your phone of each new episode. You can subscribe on whatever app you're using, or if you've never listened to it on your phone, you can download one of the free apps, podcast playing apps, and just type in our name, Creating a Family, and you can subscribe right there as well. This show is brought to you, and we're very proud to say that, it continues to be brought to you by Ferring Pharmaceutical, our corporate sponsor. For many patients, cost can be a barrier to pursuing fertility treatment. That's why Ferring offers a cost savings card for their Intermetrin vaginal inserts. This instant savings card offers up to $100 savings each month on your Intermetrin prescription for eligible patients. To get more information, you can just ask your doctor. They are sure to know about this. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors, who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Some of our great gold sponsors include Hopscotch Adoptions. They are a Hague-accredited adoption agency placing children from around the world, offering home study and post-adoption services to residents of North Carolina and New York. We have Children's Connection, Inc. They are an adoption agency with offices throughout Texas providing domestic infant adoption, embryo donation adoption, home studies, and post-adoption support to families throughout the United States. Holt International was founded in 1956 with the goal of making every child have a loving and secure home. They have programs that strengthen and preserve families that are at risk of separation, and they lead the global community in finding families for children who need them. I've already said Hopscotch. The law offices of James Fletcher Thompson. They are a South Carolina firm committed to adoption and assisted reproductive law. They also have a gestational surrogacy matching program. Nightlight Christian Adoptions has been a leader in embryo donation and adoption services for nearly 20 years through their Snowflake Adoptions program. They also have a magazine, Fertility, for the people involved with fertility and adoption, and it's called Pathway to Family. As I said, this show is on parenting kids with prenatal exposures to both drugs and alcohol. And who best to talk to than two moms who are in the midst of raising children who have these exposures? These children were adopted and at different ages, and they are currently in their tweens and teen years. So these moms have a lot of experience and a lot of compassion and a lot of education that they can provide for us. This show first aired a number of years ago and has been a very popular show and one that we wanted to bring back to you because we don't want things to get lost in our archive, particularly these little nuggets of gold that we have here, and this was one of them. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Welcome, Adrienne and Suzanne, to Creating a Family.
Thank you. Dawn. It's a privilege to be able to share.
Adrienne, let's start with you. I think it helps to begin with a basic primer on what exactly is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which is sometimes also called FASD. What exactly is this?
Well, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is caused by exposure in the utero to alcohol. So fetal exposure to alcohol in utero, sorry. Basically, any alcohol exposure while the brain is forming is going to impact the development of the brain. So what that means to kids with or people with FASD is, and I hope Suzanne can fill in where I'm missing, developmental delays, problems with emotional regulation. Children can be hyperactive. They can be over or under responsive to stimuli. They might have cognitive issues, learning disabilities. What else, Suzanne?
Yeah, this is Suzanne. I would say, you know, to kind of summarize it all, that probably one really important thing is just that when the brain is exposed to alcohol, that how we see that after the child has been born is through behavior. Oftentimes there's no physical sign. The child can look very typical, but we notice through their behavior that something is different and they don't respond and function as perhaps a typical child would. So there are a variety of areas that can be affected, and every single child that is affected by alcohol is different.
We often hear of the term fetal alcohol syndrome. How does fetal alcohol syndrome differ from, or is it a part of, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? Suzanne, I meant that question for you.
The difference between fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is simply that fetal alcohol syndrome, you see physical characteristics, and most commonly different facial characteristics that are different than a typical child. And for a child to have those facial characteristics, they are exposed to alcohol somewhere between the days of 18 and 21 of gestation, when the face is being formed. So a child could be exposed to alcohol all throughout pregnancy or at different times, but it's only during those days that the face is forming and that you see different characteristics, facial characteristics, that put a child in the category of fetal alcohol syndrome versus the spectrum disorder, which is a much bigger kind of umbrella term that fetal alcohol syndrome falls under.
This is Adrienne. I'd also add that a child can not have facial features, and the degree of FASD that they have can actually be more severe. For a long time, kids were only diagnosed with FAS if they had these facial features, but the impact is throughout pregnancy. So it's actually a lot more accurate now that we think about it in terms of a spectrum instead of that one physical marker.
I am so glad you said that, because I think there is a misconception out there that children with the characteristic facial features are automatically the more affected children. And the wisdom now seems to be that, in fact, the facial features, as you have well said, is simply whether or not they've been exposed to alcohol during the period of gestation when the facial features are being formed, and it is not necessarily reflective of the degree of impact. And did I say that correctly, Adrienne?
Yes.
Okay, excellent.
This is Suzanne. I just want to add one little thing at the end of that. And actually, the children that don't have the syndrome actually end up sometimes having a much more difficult time because they don't have any physical features, but they can be much more affected. But it's not so clear what their behaviors are caused by. So in reality, those that have the syndrome sometimes receive much more support and understanding than those that are under the label of FASD but don't have any physical features, because people expect different from them, even though they could be more affected.
And how does, Adrian, how does alcohol exposure in her utero during pregnancy, the impact of alcohol exposure, differ from the impact of drug exposure? And can we make kind of a general broad categorization of exposures? And
sure.
And do you know?
Well, I don't know a whole lot about other exposures, but I do know that alcohol is the number one worst teratogen during pregnancy. So, and I also know that people who are using illegal or even prescription, you know, illegal drugs, prescribed medications that are dangerous to fetus during pregnancy, recreationally or because they're an addict, are also highly likely to be consuming alcohol at the same time.
Right.
So people don't just, you know, smoke crack during, if they're going to use it during pregnancy, they're probably also doing other things. But overall, alcohol exposure is actually the worst poison to the developing fetus that I'm aware of.
Yeah, it's
this
one
is
of those.
Suzanne, can I add one little thing to the end of that?
Absolutely, please do. I want you to.
That, yes, what I understand is that alcohol is a solvent, which is different than other drugs, which are not. And so what the mother drinks in alcohol, that exact amount and dose goes directly through the placenta. There's no barrier there. And it's like the brain is bathed in the amount of alcohol that the mother drinks, whereas with other drugs, it's not that they don't do harm, but they're not solvents. So not the baby doesn't receive necessarily the full dose that the mother is consuming. And though all drugs have some effects on the fetus, which vary a lot from drug to drug, alcohol, as Adrian said, is the substance that affects more areas or more wider range of areas than any other drug.
It is somewhat ironic that the one legal drug is the worst, has the most teratogenic, I guess is the word, the greatest impact on a fetus. We talked at the beginning about some of the typical impairments that we see, and let's kind of break them down broadly. One, between some of the emotional and then some of the developmental, and I realize there's tremendous overlap between all of those. What are some of the developmental, and I would include cognitive within that, issues that we that you sometimes see, or often see, I should say, with children who fall under the FASD umbrella? Suzanne?
I would say developmentally, it's very common that children have what's called an uneven development. So that, for example, my son who is 10, in many areas he's functioning more like a 5-year-old. Socially, for example, he tends to play better with younger children. His vocabulary and what he can say actually looks sometimes like a child more older than he is, like 12 years old, but actually what he's understanding in conversation could be more like a child, again, of like 4 or 5. So there's this, whereas we all have uneven development, we're not the same, we don't develop the same in every single area. In these kids, it tends to be more drastic, the differences in the different areas as they develop. That's one area. You said developmentally, and what was the other?
And then cognitively, let's also include that as well. How much of cognitive impairment is typical with kids under the definition of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders?
Right. I believe that they say the average IQ of a child affected by alcohol is around 75, but there's a huge range, you know, from up into the hundreds all the way, you know, to much lower than that. And so I also think that they're saying that IQ is a very, not a very effective way to actually measure cognitive abilities in daily life, because a child with FASD can actually have an IQ that's even above normal, but you don't see that. It doesn't look like that in daily living because of their other impairments. So, again, it's a spectrum, and it's very – there's a wide range.
Yeah, and I think that's important to note, that there is a wide range. Although, is it fair to say that as a general rule, you would expect alcohol to impair the cognitive abilities of a child? In other words, it's more common that a child would have a lower ability to learn than a child who has not been exposed. Suzanne, is that a fair assessment or summary?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Maybe it's just the phrasing of it that I'm not sure they – some, yes, definitely have perhaps a lower ability, but I think maybe a better word is just that they learn differently. So perhaps, you know, the standard techniques that we use to teach children, it appears that they aren't learning, but they truly can learn using different techniques and kind of opening up the what that means to be able to learn. So I guess that's how I would respond to that.
If the average IQ is 75, in the general population, I believe the average is 100. So if – and I don't know – I have not seen the statistics of which have been done on the population of kids with FASD to really know. But if it's – so it does sound like there is some – across the board as a general rule.
Right.
But it's a good point that even kids that oftentimes changing the way we are approaching education and the way we are trying to help them learn can impact. That's across the board with all forms of learning disabilities. All right. Now, let's also talk some about the behavioral, even though I think that is often tied into some of the developmental issues. But let's just say, shift a bit and talk about behavioral. Adrian, what are some of the behaviors that are typically seen in kids who've been exposed to alcohol?
Well, I think part of the one problem that Suzanne and I'm speaking for Suzanne and I am having is you're talking about typical, and FASD is the range is so wide.
Mm-hmm.
So for every behavior I list that my son might have, you know, Suzanne's son might have a different behavior. The other thing is the more that you understand FASD and its impact and how your child's brain works, and the more you accommodate that, the more the behaviors that you don't like might recede a little bit. So I just want your listeners to know if their kids have FASD and you know, I don't want them yelling at the radio, like, that's not my kid. My kid doesn't do that, because I think that it's really unique to the child. So that said.
And that makes good sense, because although the impairment, we know that the brain is being impaired, that also has to factor into the child's personality, the child's temperament,
sure.
The environment.
Of course.
And anything
else that's going on, right? How you react to that child.
Mm-hmm.
But I can talk a little bit about some of the behaviors, and these are specific to my son. But in talking to other people, I think that they're similar. So, you know, a lot of kids with FASD have kind of what can be perceived as ADHD-like behaviors, so hyperactivity or spacing out, but that also might be connected to feeling overstimulated or seeking stimulation in the environment. So, for example, at night, my son, when he's tired and he's kind of had a lot of stuff going on in the day, he might do things like he'll get very active and he'll kind of want to fling himself around, and he's trying to get input out of things, and he'll get very noisy. And he'll just be seeking input. So that's one thing that he does. Another issue that you see often in kids with FASD might be sleep, problems with sleep. My son has never needed enough as much sleep as the rest of us in our house, and so there's kind of been that's created a problem in our house, because he wants to be awake, and we do not want to be awake. We want to be asleep. He has like Suzanne's, and this goes back to the brain function. So my son has auditory processing problems, which means that if you speak to him, it takes him a lot longer than other people to understand what you're saying. So if he's in a group and someone's speaking to the group kind of rapid fire, he really doesn't know what's going on. So you can see in a classroom that would create a problem. He has to buy himself time to process. And so on a good day, he'll say, what do you mean, to buy himself time. And on a bad day, he'll just say, shut up. So this is an oppositional behavior, but it's oppositional only because he needs more time to process. I don't know, Suzanne. I'm sure you can think of some.
Yeah, I was going to say, Suzanne, can you add to the list of behaviors that you've seen with your children?
Yeah, I can add to that. I think another big area is what's labeled kind of executive functioning behaviors, mm-hmm. which another that's kind of typical and that's definitely an issue for my son is kind of getting stuck. Like having a really hard time transitioning from one activity to the next. So whereas a lot of children, you know, you kind of give them warning that you're going to be ending an activity and going on to the next, and they kind of are able to do that. My son has a really, really hard time going from one thing to the next. So, you know, if somebody makes him stop something and go to something else without trying to prevent what could come, he often has big temper tantrums and shouting and anger, and he's also as a result of that a child that functions much better with routines, and when everything's as much as possible can be the same every day, it's a very hard time with changes in schedule or unexpected things happening. He's also very impulsive, which is another very common characteristic in kids with FASD, as well as, I think, like school-wise, these children tend to be very concrete, which definitely my younger son is, and have a hard time with abstract concepts. So, for example, math is often a very difficult subject for them. They have a hard time really understanding, like, the value of money and, you know, what that means on a daily basis. Also, issues in learning and memory, a lot, the kind of difficulties with both, like, what Adrian was saying, short-term auditory memory for processing disorders. And their kids sometimes, which my son does this a lot too, that they can actually, you know, say, for example, all the rules at home or at school,
yeah.
but they have a really hard time applying those to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they can verbally say, yes, you know, we're supposed to do this and this and this and this, they'd have a hard time understanding what that really means for them and being able to apply that to their own life. I could go on and on, maybe.
Well, one of the things that occurs to me is that, and it's an interesting thought, is that many of the behaviors you're talking about mimic and overlap other conditions, other disorders, or just some general learning disabilities. Much of what the executive function, the impulsivity mimicking, ADHD, concrete learning. So some of the techniques that we use for all children who are the square pegs in the round hole world would be effective as well. I want to get to this question from Lorraine. She says, I'm curious if your guest knew that their children were affected by alcohol or had FASD when they adopted them. We are starting the process of adoption, and we are trying to decide if we are open to this risk. I would appreciate any insight your guest might have. So I think what Lorraine may be asking is kind of a if you knew then what you know now type of question. But first, and I do want to get to that, but let's first address her question, which was how much did you know when you were adopting your children? And Suzanne, let's start with you, and then Adrian, if you would follow.
Okay.
I knew that their biological mother was an alcoholic. And when I adopted my older son, That's kind of as much, I mean, that's kind of as far as I thought about that. And I had my older son for a whole year before I adopted my younger son, who's his biological brother. And so that first year with my older son was pretty typical what I thought it would be. I knew it would be difficult, but he is minimally affected. And so he's very, very capable, he converses, and we really got through a lot of issues. And he acts pretty much like a typical child. Whereas my younger son, I was able to observe him in various circumstances, situations before I adopted him, and I could see that his behavior was very different than my older son. And so I'm a nurse, and so I kind of suspected that perhaps the alcohol exposure had something to do with what I was seeing. So I actually went into the University of Washington's Diagnostic Center, and I kind of diagnosed him myself by everything I was reading. And so I feel like, yes, by the time I made the decision to adopt him, I was pretty sure that alcohol exposure had something to do with the little guy that he is and what I was observing.
Adrienne, how about you with your son?
So we adopted Jamie when he was 15 months old, and we adopted him from Russia. And we had paperwork that said his mother was an alcoholic. So I guess, you know, we knew theoretically he had been exposed to alcohol, but, you know, honestly, we had no idea what that meant. And I'm not really going to blame anyone for that except ourselves, because FASD is not as well known as it should be, because it actually affects huge amounts of people. but you know, it's not information isn't as pushed in your face about it as many other disabilities. So, yes, we knew, but the other thing was, so Jamie was 15 months old, and, you know, Suzanne explained before, this is a lot of times a big developmental delay. So at 15 months, if you're living in a Russian orphanage and you're developmentally delayed, it's kind of, you know, you're right in there with everybody else there. So initially we didn't see very much different between him and other kids his age. It started to manifest itself more as he got older, as we started to expect more in terms of self-control and behavior. So we knew what we didn't know, and it wasn't for several years that we really understood what it meant. And it actually wasn't until, I would say, the last 2 years that we really, really understood what it meant.
And something I wanted, just before we get to the if you knew then what you know now type of question, but before we get to that, I want to emphasize something you said, and that is, I think this is often the case that it becomes, you said it was more manifested as your son aged, and I think that is very often the case because, and you said it beautifully, the expectations of a 2-year-old are one thing, but the expectations of a 5 and a 6-year-old are different. And often these children don't look that significantly different at 2. They could, but they, and especially with some of the, like the executive functioning, the higher level thinking, all of that doesn't really come into play until children reach, you know, oftentimes older ages, and then you start seeing, wait a minute, this child is a very concrete, is not able to work in the abstract. So those type of things, I think we hear that a lot from people as well, and I think that is important to note. And it's a hard, and the next part of Lorraine's question is, she's trying, in the process of trying to decide whether or not she's up to the risk. Do you have any thoughts to share with her? It's a hard question to answer, I think. But Suzanne, do you have any thoughts for Lorraine? She's sitting on the pre-adoption side. Anything, any any words of wisdom you could share with her?
Yes, I would say that that to me personally, it's all worth it. And I think my son has opened a whole new world to me, and I see things from a totally different perspective, and he teaches me so much. Is it hard? Yes, extremely hard. Every day is hard. It's full of great rewards, but I would say, you know, as long as whoever is adopting a child with alcohol issues understands that it will not be an easy road, probably for their whole life, that there will be issues, that it will be difficult, and they're willing to learn from the child as well as, you know, all the information that's available, and to fight for that child, I think it's definitely worth the risk. But if, you know, whoever is adopting a child with fetal alcohol issues doesn't realize that or doesn't want to acknowledge or doesn't really want to be willing to live a life that's not going to be easy, then I would say probably it's not worth the risk, because it will be a difficult thing for everybody.
Adrian, anything that you could add for advice you could give Lorraine?
Well, I think that Suzanne said it really well. I mean, if you the problem with people and children with FASD is you can't make their brain damage go away. You know, mm-hmm. You can't love their brain damage away. You can't, you know, there are therapies and all children respond differently to them, and there's different methods you can use. And, you know, certainly understanding it has been the most effective in my house, but you're not going to, like, super mom it into submission, if that makes sense. So just to go into it knowing that, but then the other part is that to know that this is not going to be a child who necessarily, I mean, I guess it happens for some people, but who necessarily at 18 or 19 or 20 is going to leave and be independent. So you're talking about a longer period of parenting for kids like this. You know, so not to think about, oh, at 18 they'll be out of the house, or at 20 they'll be out of the house, or even at 25 they'll be out of the house. You know, you're going to need to have some involvement with them, or somebody's going to need to have some involvement mm-hmm. with them. Because they're just not going to be, in the early years, as I understand it, not going to be as able to be independent as your typical person that age. That doesn't mean they'll never be independent. And it's more a concept of interdependence. You know, it also doesn't mean they're going to have to live in their childhood room their whole life. It's going to depend on the kid. But just to know that it's a long haul. And it is very tiring. But... The more that you educate yourself, the better it goes. So it's possible, certainly. But that's all.
Okay, that's fine.
This is Suzanne. I just want to dovetail off of that it also is important to realize that, you know, as we've been saying, it is a spectrum. So there are children, as Adrian is saying, that may not ever gain total independence or need some kind of, you know, interdependence all of their life, whereas others who are minimally affected might have a very typical-looking development and follow a more typical road. So that, I guess the issue is you don't know that. You don't know that when you adopt a child with fetal alcohol issues, how affected they are until, you know, they start growing up. And as you said, a lot of times you don't see really their disability until they get to be about school age. Mm-hmm. And then you start seeing a lot more of the actual ability to function in different areas. So, you know, nobody can give you a pat answer, you know, what's the future of this child going to look like. I don't think anybody knows that with any of these children.
Well, and look at your two sons are a good example. Both came you don't have any evidence of if her alcoholism was different from one than the other. It might well have been, but you don't know. Both came from the same mother, same alcoholic mother, and a mother with alcoholism, and your sons are significantly differently affected.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a case in point. You are listening to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and infertility. Creating a Family is a nonprofit providing education and support for adoption and infertility. All of our resources are offered without charge to adoptive families and adoption professionals. You can find them online at creatingafamily.org. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter at the top left of any page on our site. Today we're talking about how to best raise a child that has been exposed to alcohol or drugs in utero. We have a panel of true experts, moms who are in the midst of raising children who have FASD, Suzanne Emery and Adrian Basista. Adrian is also the co-editor and contributor to the book and blog, Easy to Love but Hard to Raise, Real Parents and Challenging Kids, True Stories. So now I want to kind of move to a discussion on what works at helping these kids. And this is a question we received from Steve that would be a good intro to that. Steve says, we don't know for sure, but we have good suspicion that our son has FASD. We know that his birth mother did not drink after the fourth month of pregnancy because she was in jail, but we don't know before that. Our son's behavior is erratic. He is very affectionate and often tries hard to be good, but then he just seems to lose it and go berserk. It's like anything stressful can set him off. He is really a great kid in so many ways, but he is really struggling in school and with making friends. So let's talk some about what might help Steve and other parents who have children who are struggling, likely as a result of exposure to alcohol during their gestation. What have you found, Suzanne, to be effective? You had mentioned routines, and so I thought that might be a good place to begin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the basis of really what started changing things for us was getting to the place of being able to understand the root of behaviors as there's kind of a different way to talk about behaviors, both primary behaviors that are actually a result of brain damage, and then secondary behaviors or characteristics that are actually a result of living from chronic stress and frustration. So I think kind of finding somewhere where, either a professional or there's wonderful resources on the internet that you can educate yourself to understand how brain damage affects behavior, understanding the roots of behavior, and then understanding, as Adrian was saying, that we're not going to really change a lot of the primary behaviors, but what does change is when we stop trying to actually change the child and change, for example, me, changing the way I'm reacting to my son and seeing that really I'm the one that has to change because he's the one with the disability. So when I kind of began to understand that, it has made all the difference in the world. Not that it's easy, but I have to always come back to myself and say, okay, what's, looking, observing, what's causing this behavior? How can I respond in a way that helps instead of creating more frustration and stress, which what I'm talking about is called the neurobehavioral model. And so to me, that has made all the difference in the way I parent and really helping my child build on his strengths instead of continuing to try to make him change his weaknesses or the things that are really hard for him.
Could you give us an example of the let me repeat what you said on the primary behaviors are those behaviors that result from the brain damage. The secondary behaviors are those behaviors that result from living with stress, not fitting in, living with a disability. Is that a fair summary of what you just said?
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good way to
say. Can you give us an example of a primary behavior and how that, and then an example of a secondary behavior? And Suzanne, I'm going to direct this question back to you, but Adrienne, after she finishes, if you've got something to add, please join in.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. A really recent example is we, after trying many, many different schools that never worked, we're homeschooling my son now, and he has a new teacher that's trying to learn all this right now. And so she was having him do math, and he was supposed to be labeling like a story problem, like 6 apples plus 2 apples equals 8 apples. And the instruction said that he was supposed to write the word apples, you know, 6 apples, write the word out in this sentence. And for him, writing is extremely difficult. And this would be what would be considered a primary characteristic for many different reasons. His eye-hand coordination, his ability to focus and to there's a lot of different brain functions that go into being able to actually write, and that is a very difficult thing for him. And so when she insisted that he do that, he became very disrespectful to her. He became very angry and left the table. Those characteristics, what I just mentioned, being disrespectful, getting angry, avoiding a situation, are the secondary characteristics. What happens when we continue to obligate a child to do something that their brain actually can't do or has a very difficult time doing? So in this situation, you know, I came home and she was talking about this, and I said, you know, what would happen if instead of making him write the word apples, you gave him the option of drawing a picture of an apple? And that totally solved the problem. He loves drawing. That's a strength of his. He loves drawing and coloring and all that. And so just making that little tiny change made all the difference for him and took away those secondary characteristics of getting mad and disrespectful and all those things, because we were meeting his need and the way he functions.
Okay. That's a great example. All right. So anything that you can add or any examples you could give us, Adrienne, from your family of something that would be primary, the result of the brain damage,
sure,
versus secondary. Go ahead.
I mentioned this before, that my son has kind of an auditory processing issue. So it takes him a longer to understand what you've said to him. He just kind of needs a minute. He needs a beat. I always call it a beat. So if you say something to him like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of something, even something good.
I'll give you an example of one that I know, because I also, I understand, I also live with learning disabilities in our house, so I do understand that. Do you want to go to the park?
Right.
You know, he's processing and he's still trying to think. Yeah.
Right. Do you want to go to the park? And so he might, if I give him space, you know, and don't require and kind of do my own thing, he'll say yes or no, or a lot of times he'll say what, but he doesn't really mean what. He just means give me a minute. But, you know, on a bad day, on a day when we've had a lot of stress and disagreements, he might say shut up, or you're stupid, or use swear words or something to me. So the primary is the auditory processing, and then the secondary is this oppositional and sometimes profane, aggressive language. And so, you know, I think conventional parenting wisdom says you need to take care of that mouth right now, you know, but mm-hmm. that's actually not a good approach, because if I start addressing that, it starts getting even more confusing. He still doesn't know if he wants to go to the park or not, you know,
yeah.
And now I'm angry at him for swearing at me, which he said out of impulsivity. And in a time of calm, we can talk about it. And he's very, very apologetic. I'm thinking back to the man who asked the question about, he knows that his son means to be good, but sometimes he goes berserk. I mean, Meissen always means to be good. That's, you know, I try to give him the big benefit of the doubt there. He is like anyone. He wants to please. His motivation when he does these things, it's not, he doesn't have some ulterior motive. It's, you know, it's pure impulse. It's pure, you know, drawing back on his fear or his anger when he does these things.
Yeah. That's a, yes, I completely understand that. So understanding and distinguishing between that which our children are able to do and those things that are, and that being the primary, versus the way they're reacting and behaving, which is the result of the stress often caused by living with the primary, is one method that you're talking that has truly helped both of you, it sounds like, working with your children. How has school been? I mean, you've mentioned, Adrian, that you, or was it Suzanne? I think it was Suzanne who says that you are now homeschooling your youngest son. Is your eldest son is in school, I take it, Suzanne?
He is, yes. He's in a private school.
Okay. Adrian, how has school been for your son?
Well, we also homeschool.
Yeah.
We dropped out about halfway through second grade. You know, there were a lot of problems with school and my son. One is big groups don't work that well for him. He needs a lot of reminders of what's the right thing to do. He needs a lot of concrete reminders of what's the right thing to do. He needs a lot of reminders about what he's supposed to be doing. So in that way, as he kind of advanced through the grades and the support became less because, you know, you don't have as many teachers, assistants, classes get bigger, and expectations got bigger, both academically and socially. You know, if you take this idea that kids with FASD are half their chronological age developmentally. I mean, if you're 9 and you're in class with 9-year-olds, but developmentally you're about 4, you're not really able to deal with them on their, you know, on the same developmental level. So there were just a multitude of things that didn't work for him, and he had some very nice people involved with him at school, but eventually we just decided it wasn't really serving his needs. And then add to that, like Suzanne's son, my son has a really hard time with handwriting. He has a really hard time with math. His strengths academically is reading, which doesn't mean he reads better than a 10-year-old. It just means that's his best thing. Right now, academically, and also content, especially things like nature and building and things and making things and, you know, visual, understanding things visually. He's pretty good at those things. And, you know, that's not really what they do in traditional school all day long. And so it's that strengths-based model is – I just decided he didn't need to be spending 6-7 hours a day doing things that were, in reality, just not going to be something he was very good at. It doesn't mean we don't do academics. We do academics, but we don't spend 6-7 hours a day on it. We spend a little bit of time on that, and then we spend a whole lot of time on things that he's good at. And one thing he's really good at is, if he's with adults, being a helper to other people. My stepdad, my son's grandpa, takes him to 2 community functions every week where he helps. He helps with this community lunch for people who are homeless or, you know, otherwise can't eat. And they love him there. He does a great job there. And he also takes him to the farmer's market where they get the farmers to give food for the community lunch. And so this kind of social skills, talking to adults, being helpful in that way, this has really boosted him where when he was spending all day in an environment where he couldn't do most of it, it really brought him down. So, you know, I do know that I've heard stories that some schools do pretty well by their kids with FASD, and of course it is a spectrum. Some kids are going to be pretty good in school if they have FASD academics-wise, but for my son it just didn't make any sense anymore, and we're really lucky that we live in a state that where the homeschool rules are, we're are able to accommodate what he needs.
Yeah, so that is, so it sounds like another thing that, in addition to distinguishing between primary and secondary behaviors, it sounds like another thing that is useful is to find your child's strengths and structure as much opportunity to focus on those strengths as possible. That's another, it sounds like another aspect of parenting a child, a practical tip for parenting a child with FASD. Suzanne, you've mentioned the neurobehavioral model. What is that, and where can people get more information on that?
Uh-huh. Well, the neurobehavioral model was developed by somebody named Diane Malbin. She is a specialist in FASD and created that model, and a lot of information can be found on her website, which is www.facets.com. facets.org. So I would say, yeah, that's a good place to start. She has written a book as well that is called Trying Differently Rather Than Harder. That's another wonderful resource that also introduces the neurobehavioral model. So I'd say those are probably the best sources to find that. And I know, you know, there are people around the country who have received her trainings. She does trainings in different places of the United States and even internationally. But it's a matter of trying to find professionals who are aware of that model or researching yourself, learning yourself, or going to a conference that teaches that model.
Excellent. Yes, and there are conferences around, and there are other books that kind of, and I don't know because I haven't read hers, although I will because it does sound great, but All Kinds of Minds is another book that tends to focus on the same thing where we focus on the strengths, we understand it's not specific to children who have FASD, however, so it may be of less direct use. Have you been able to, what are the techniques that either of you use for helping your child make and keep friends? Because some of the behaviors that we often see with children with FASD interferes with their ability to make friends, as well as in ability to function in groups and things such as that. Let's start with you, Suzanne. Any thoughts on things that you've been able to do to help your son with the social aspects of life?
Right. Yeah, as I mentioned before, he tends to play really well with children a little bit younger than his age. So we fortunately have neighbors that are quite a bit younger, who are his best friends. He plays with them every chance he gets that they're all home, and that usually works out very well. We live in a little condominium where we can kind of see out in the parking area where they play. And so sometimes, you know, I need to come out and intervene or help out in some way. But that usually is a good scenario. I have also kind of made a tradition with both of my boys that on Fridays we kind of have play dates or they can invite friends over to our house. And Edwin tends to do really well, my younger son, with one friend. With just even a child his age, he does pretty good just with one friend. But when you add more kids to the pile, it gets more complicated. So just having kind of one-on-ones. And then I have actually, I take him to my older son's school once a week, and he participates in PE with the kids that are his chronological age that he actually started kindergarten with. So he sees that group still as kind of his group of friends. And we have had some difficulties in different situations there. So I just asked the teacher if she would let me come in one day and just on a third grade level, talk to the children about brains and how our brains work differently and, you know, why Edwin does some of the stuff he does and how they could be really good friends and, you know, help Edwin out in different ways and how Edwin, you know, just values all of them so much. And that was really a wonderful time because they, I think kids have an incredible way of understanding, sometimes even better than adults. Mm-hmm. And since then, things have gone more smoothly. You know, sometimes I have to remind them, you know, just remember, you know, when you talk to Edwin, sometimes you need to tell him things more than once. He really wants to cooperate and he's not trying to hurt you, but you might need to tell him more than once, you know, whatever it is. So I think those are kind of some of the strategies that I've used to help him socially.
Okay, Adrian, any thoughts on how you might, as a parent, help our, how we can help our kids from a social standpoint?
Well, I mean, I think Suzanne, you know, hit it on the head there with the one-on-one and playing with kids younger. We belong to a homeschool playgroup that meets weekly, and he really gravitates towards the younger kids, and I'm happy that we're in an, you know, he doesn't have to stick the same age. It's multi-age. Also, he goes to a camp that a lot of the kids go to this camp, you know, over and over and over again, so he's part of a larger community that way. He is definitely missing, like, best friends, very rare invites to birthday parties or play dates, things like that. So, I mean, I know if you asked him, he would say that makes him sad that he doesn't have good friends. But we continue to work on it. I'm always trying to figure out kids who might get along with him.
Well, you know, one of the things I hear you say, and I've heard other parents, and both of you have said it, is that you initiate the contact. You don't you seek out friends, people that kids that you think might be more compassionate or more patient or
right.
are slightly younger, and you create the environment, you create the opportunity.
Right.
Yeah, and I've heard that from other parents as well, is that you've got to be on the lookout. You have to be proactive because these kids are often the ones who aren't invited to the birthday parties. Are not invited on the play dates and things like that. But, and unfortunately, as our children age, that we are less able, to play that role with our children. So it's important to do it when we can. And I liked your idea, too, about choosing an environment like the camp you mentioned where the child can go every year. That makes it less of a new and a new environment that the child has to adjust to, which is a plus for many kids with FASD. Plus, it increases the odds that your child might run into or be exposed to children who at least understand him or her and their behavior. So I hadn't thought of that one, and that's a great idea. Go ahead.
Sorry, this is Adrian. The other part of that is things like camps, and, you know, extracurricular type activities, as long as there is an adult there who really gets what my son needs, it tends to go pretty well. There's a different summer camp near us where the director started out working at the whole, I think they're called the hole-in-the-wall camp, so their camp specifically for kids with all different special needs. They have different weeks throughout the summer for kids with special needs. And this guy, even though he really understands my son and he doesn't expect him, even though he looks like everybody else, he doesn't expect him to act like everyone else, which is a lot of times the trouble you get when dealing with unfamiliar adults. And so this director has made this particular summer camp amazing because my son can go. He feels like everybody else there. But if there's some problem, he knows who to go to, you know.
Exactly.
He's got an adult ally there who really gets him. And, you know, everybody needs that.
Well, thank you so much, Adrian Basista and Suzanne Emery, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. We've mentioned a number of resources, including, I'll give it again, the FASCETS.org, facets.org, a great resource. The Creating a Family website, creatingafamily.org, has a section on FASD. We link to the FACETS website as well. And I believe we also link to the Easy to Love, Hard to Parent Facebook resources as well. You can also get more information on Adrienne and on her new project of creating an organization to provide training and education for families affected by FASD on her website, adriennebassista.net, and that's A-D-R-I-E-N-N-E-B-A-S-H-I-S-T-A. And you can get more information there. Creating a Family has the largest adoption and infertility communities on the social networks, and we would love to have you join us. We talk about all sorts of things, including FASD and the practical ideas for those who are parenting children with FASD. On Twitter, you can find us on a number of ways. One, Dawn Davenport One, and the other one is Creating a Family, all run together. And, of course, the at symbol is before all of those. On Facebook, you can find us at dawn.davenport1 or our Facebook group, Creating a Family, well, Facebook page, first of all, Creating a Family, as well as our Creating a Family Facebook support group. The easiest way to find the Facebook support group is just to type in the words Creating a Family, and both the page and the group pop up. We'd love to have you like the page and join the group. The UN estimates that there are 143 million orphans in the world, including 107,000 currently available for adoption in the U.S. foster care system. These kids, as well as the millions of older kids throughout the world, deserve a home. To get more information about the U.S. kids waiting for a family, you can go to the adoption resource page of creatingafamily.org, where we include links to various photo listings of some of these kids. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the...
Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon. Yeah. That's Hugo tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.